What is up, Podheads? Back with another episode of the Podio Slave Podcast. My name is Tony. I am joined by Anthony. We are back for part two of our conversation with Alex Dunn of Crime and Stereo. And we really appreciate you checking out part one. If you did, if you're here for the first time, go back and listen to part one, which was last week's episode. Anthony, how you doing, man? Really excited about this, you know, getting this second half out into the world.
Dude, yeah. I mean, I think the response from part one was phenomenal. And if you're a legacy crime guy or just got in from House and Trance, this second episode will be awesome. Even if you're just a music fan in general and you listen to us and don't even know Crime and Stereo, there's a lot of, it does give a behind the scenes of really what it is to be a band in 2024 now, right? I mean, it's a lot of people have jobs, a lot of people, like, things take time. And, you know, in the case of Crime and Stereo with Pure Noise and, you know, there's a pandemic in there, but yeah, this does pick up pretty much in terms of year, like 2013 to the present. It was after kind of the Bridge Nine era. They kind of disappeared for a bit, still in touch, still kind of writing. And this is the lead up to House and Trance, which I told them in the episode, and I stand by it, album of the year for 2023. Banger.
Yeah, it's a phenomenal record. If you haven't listened to House and Trance from Crime and Stereo, came out back in October of 23, go peep that. Because we dig into songs and how they came to be and, you know, the creative process behind that record a little bit in this episode too. So, yeah, this one reminded me a lot of our first conversation with Damian Moyale, which I think we bring up in the episode. We talk a lot about the early days of As Friends Rust, and then we kind of pivoted to just music in general. And that kind of happened a little. I mean, we stuck with a little more Crime and Stereo stuff here, but because it was more to talk about. But we pivoted to, you know, what the lay of the land is as a band in 2024 and what it means to be in hardcore, all that stuff. It was a really fun second half of this conversation. So we're happy you're back to check it out.
And you know what? Maybe there'll be part three. And we could take it in so many angles. We haven't recorded it. I'm not saying it's like a lost tape type of thing.
Yeah, right.
But it'll probably make the cut here, but we talk about already wanting to have him back in the episode, you know, maybe bring in some friends, deep dive in albums, deep dive in Long Island. We hit it off. And if it wasn't so late, we could have gone the Joe Rogan special and gone like 4 hours.
We easily could have done another hour.
He talked most of it too. And that's, I find that, you know, some of the best conversations, this goes for outside the podcast, or just when you're a listener, when you're just listening to him. I mean, there's a reason why we have guests on. It's not for us to tell our story, although, you know, we weave it in. But yeah, Alex, if you're listening, thank you, man. This was everything we thought it would be and hoped it would be. And
yeah, let's get into part two, second half of Anthony's Super Bowl right here with Alex Dunn of Crime and Stereo.
Let's do it. I guess to recap here, Troubled Stateside all-time record, Is Dead comes out. There's some curveballs, like there's left of center stuff. And as fans, you're like, well, this is amazing. I didn't expect this, especially from a Bridge Nine release. And then I was trying to describe you to someone, comes out, and it's even more. It's like a screwball in the opposite direction, but I still love it. So then the breakup, we don't have to get into the breakup. Maybe we'll have you on for another time and we can get into the breakup. But so 2010, 2011 comes around. And that's what seems like is the end of it. As a fan, I'm like, all right, well, I'm not done. I wish they weren't done, you know? So then, you know, there's the Is Dead shows in 2017. And then actually, I remember in like 2012, there were Long Island shows. So like you continued to play out, but there was no releases. So then
we broke up in 2010. Then we played one show in 2012 because Movie Life did their last show. Movie Life, weirdly, never played a final show. They had played a show the night before. They were like in the middle of a tour. They had played a show the night before and like after the show broke up and drove home and that was it. And they never played again. So that was like 2000 and I don't know, two or three or four, somewhere around there.
It was three. We know.
It was 2003, okay. Yeah.
It was Skate Fest.
It was Skate Fest 03.
So then in 2012, I want to say around then, I was living with Vin at the time. Me and Vin were roommates and we were living in a house that was owned by Brian from Brand New. And they did. And again, we've all been friends for our whole lives. And Movie Life came up with this idea that they were going to do a final show, the final Movie Life show in Times Square at like the PlayStation Theater, this giant, huge room. And just kind of like said jokingly in passing, like, why don't you guys open the show, meaning us and Brand New? And we were both like, yeah, totally. Even though we were broken up at this point, it just seemed like a cool thing to do. And so we played that one show with the three of us. And then I think the next year we reformed, which was kind of like, I don't really know. Like we quote unquote got back together and then very quickly realized that we couldn't do the things that like a band needs to do. When we got back together, it was with the same lineup, the original lineup.
Right on.
Yeah. And there were just like too many, you know, two of the relationships in the band had frayed beyond a salvageable point at that point. And so then it was like, well, now we're back together, but like we're at each other's throats again. We can't practice. We can't write. We can't do any of this. And so then eventually, I'm fast forwarding here, eventually we get Eric Fairchild, our current bass player, and Brett Romness, who everybody knows as the Rat, our drummer. And that was like, I think Eric joined 2013, Rat joined 2015. And then we were like a real band again. And we've been a real band ever since, except privately. Like we're on a group text and we hang out together all the time and we talk literally every single day. And we're just like the best of friends, but we just didn't do anything out in the real world, really, for no real reason. And then we did the Is Dead shows and we were kind of like felt like we were gearing up. We signed to Pure Noise and then COVID hit. And so then that was the same whole spiel.
Well, and there was a record in 2016 that was scrapped?
Yes. When we got back together with the really, in my brain, there's two Crime and Stereo lineups. There's the original lineup that was on all of the albums through Trying to Describe You, and then we broke up. And then this period where we were trying to get back together but couldn't. And then from 2015 on is the second iteration of Crime and Stereo, which is me and Christian and Gary, who have always been in the band, and Eric and Brett. And we did make a record, the most of a record. If anybody has heard that song, The Good Empire, you can Google it. I'm sure there's a Crime and Stereo song called The Good Empire that only exists on a Bandcamp page because we gave it to a local venue here to use as like a fundraiser when they were going to lose the venue. But that song is from that session. That's the only song we've ever released from that session. And we had this stuff and it's good. It's not good.
It's good. Good Empires.
That song's awesome.
I was walking my dog tonight. I'm like, I texted Tony and I'm like, dude, this is amazing. I want that record.
Yeah.
Give me that fucking record.
I listened to it on my couch because you sent me the link. I was like, oh yeah. Yeah. I remember when this came out. Yeah. Yeah.
So we will release maybe a half a dozen of the songs at some point. I think there was probably only 10 of them to begin with. Some of them are done, like completely done. Others, we would have to go back and touch things up and fix things and add like leads here and leads and vocals to things. I would say there's probably 6 or 7 songs we could release some day, except like now, the problem is that like now that we kind of are like back in it and we have momentum going, we don't want to go backwards. So if we hit a wall, really more than anything, maybe what I would like to do is like, it's like if we can get another record done, and maybe Pure Noise is like, great, this is coming out in 2 years or whatever. You know, it's like, great. Then in the meantime, let's release this other thing that we have. But I don't want to go backwards. But the songs are good. I would be happy to release them someday. We didn't put it out just because we knew we could do better. And honestly, like there was no reason to, you know. This House in Trance is the album that we wanted. And I have to believe, I like to believe, that it's the album that our fans wanted. I truly believe that if you could hold both of them in your hands right now, you would be like, and you had to choose one, everybody would say, no, House in Trance is the record we're glad to have.
That's, yeah. I mean, listening to that again last night in prep to talk to you today, I'm sure that that's probably the case. You answered one of my questions, though. I was wondering if any of the 2016 stuff made it onto House in Trance. Sounds like none of it did. It's all.
None of it.
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
No, nothing. Yeah, like that's why when we started this thing, it was like, we're not doing any of it. There was a part, a point where even Brett was like, are you sure we shouldn't? There was one particular song. He's like, I think we should just put this song on the new record. And at that point, it was just like, let's not cross streams. You know, like it's not about whether or not those songs were good enough to make House in Trance. It was like, they're different batches, you know, like these are different batches, different periods, different approaches. It's just kind of like, let's not. And then at least we have the benefit of, if and when we do release that stuff, it will be cohesive.
Yeah,
it will sound like a cohesive six right or on. Seven song EP or something like that.
So when did Pure Noise come into play? When did you guys start writing the House in Trance stuff?
That's another, like, it's so funny telling these stories because it just brings up like waves of regret of like me thinking about like, man, did we fuck these guys over too? Like we've worked with like all of these amazing labels and they've all been so incredible to us. And I don't know. I don't know if we're a difficult band to work with or not, only because I don't know what other bands are like to, you know, to work with. But Pure Noise, these freaking amazing people, they signed us, gave us everything that we wanted and everything that we asked for. And then we just like, we like literally did not give them anything for at least a year. It might have been, honestly, I'd have to go back and look at like when we actually signed. I'll give you this as like, how about this as a marker that like Koyo's record, the Long Island band Koyo, came out before ours. It came out a month before ours.
It did.
And yeah. I remember when they signed, like I remember when I was told that they also had signed to Pure Noise. And I remember thinking like, holy shit, like we've been on this label for like a year and a half already.
And their rollout was so long.
Exactly. Like they rolled out their record for like a year and it came out still a month before ours. And I'm telling you, I think we were signed to the label for a year and a half before they even got signed.
Yeah, because we had Joey and Harold on in late January, early February of last year. And they were pretty much done with it. But then it was 8 months before we saw it. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so that's not cool. That's, you know, we took forever to get this record done. Basically, what happened was we did the music. There was a lot of false starts. We got the music done and then literally didn't touch it for a year. So the record came out October of 2023. The music was done October 21. So we basically recorded musically the summer and fall of 21. And then my son was born November of 21. And that was why we went on a pause there. And then a year went by. And so it was August of 22 by the time we went in to do vocals and finish leads and do mixes and stuff like that. So it did not get touched at all for an entire year from fall of 21 to fall of 22. The music sat there, but that gave us the benefit of that. Like when we went to do vocals, we had lyrics, we had, you know, melodies, like we had all of the stuff that we needed. And then fall of 22, we finished it, but then we mixed it early 23. And honestly, by the time you hand a record in now, it's almost a year before it comes out. Yep. So I think we handed it in March of 23. And
crazy.
It came out October 23.
Yeah. And then some of that's out of your hands, right? It's getting vinyl pressed. It's getting
totally
all that stuff together.
It's all the vinyl pressing. That's the whole thing. If you're not doing vinyl, they can digitally just put it online. But yeah, if you want records pressed or whatever, it's 6, 7, 8 months or whatever.
So as a Crime fanboy, I love the record. It's my album of the year for last year.
Thank you.
So good.
Thank you. That means a lot. It really does. Thank you.
Yeah, and like in a crazy way, it fits so perfect in the catalog. Like every release, this is how I view it. I'd love to hear your perspective, but like every release had to happen in order to get here. Like we were talking, Tony and I were talking about it. Like if you put Explosives against House in Trance, you'd be like, what the fuck happened in 20 years? But you have the stair steps to get there.
I did say that last night, I think.
Actually. Yes, you did. And I woke up, my daughter woke me up at like 2 a.m. and I checked my text. I'm like, he's right. It'd be fucking weird if these came out back to back. But given the progression, it was meant to be. And I think like in an Instagram post I posted about this, like the Crime in Stereo story is like the picture is coming into focus after all these years. I don't know if it, I don't know how you feel.
To be honest with you, I think this is the most this is the most cohesive record, I think, since Troubled Stateside
that we've done. Yep.
I think that maybe Crime and Stereo, I don't think of it like this, but you could, if you wanted to, like, split it into almost like two sounds, like the Troubled Stateside and earlier, like, you know, Explosives and Kill Your Idols and Contract and Stateside, and then the Is Dead and On sound. And I feel like Troubled Stateside was the perfect encapsulation of what we were trying to do with that sound. And I feel like House in Trance is the perfect encapsulation of like what we've been trying to do since.
Well, you know how I know I liked it is the night Hypernormalization and Books Cannot Be Killed by Fire came out. It was late night. I was in bed. I had headphones on. I'm alone. I'm like, what the fuck is this? You know, it was literally like that. And then the follow-up single release was Goliathat and Rogue Wave. And Goliathat has, I mean, you're noodling on the guitar. I'm like, what the fuck is this? And then I digest it for a couple months and I'm like, I'm in. This is my favorite release of the year.
Thank you. Let me ask you, how did you feel about Books Cannot Be Killed by Fire when you first heard it? I'm asking this as somebody who, I'm not sure that should have been one of the first singles released, and so I'm asking your opinion as a fan, how that hit you.
It was definitely what the fuck. And actually, that was my favorite of the two. And then my roommate back in college, who we were fanboys of Troubled Stateside in that era, he liked Hypernormalization. I was like, I like Books, because Books has the hook.
I was going to say the same
fucking
thing.
Hook of all ages. And then the ding, 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 when to start out, I'm like, it's dancey.
Cool.
Yeah. But awesome. It was what the fuck. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It was like, what the fuck is going on? Like,
that is the experience of being in Crime and Stereo. It's not terribly pleasant. It's fine that people seem to always come around on our stuff. But we would love, you know, if there was ever just like a thing that we put out where it was like hit the ground running, like, you know, where everybody's super into it from the get go, because every single one of our releases, we get what the fuck for like 6 months. That is kind of, from our
Sense
perspective, that's kind of what it seems like. And then later everybody's like, oh my God, blah, blah, blah. And it's great. It's great to hear after the fact, but we've never had, and including the Troubled Stateside, we've never had a record where we put it out and everyone went, holy shit, this is the album. You got to hear this. I can't believe it. It really is more like, I don't know if trepidation is the right word, but just kind of like, I think it takes people a minute to have it grow on them or something.
Well, it absolutely does. And a question for you, because we've kind of chronicled it in this conversation from start to now. You've always done something a little different on every release. Like, it isn't, hey, here's Troubled Stateside Part 2. Here's Is Dead Part 2. My assumption is we're not going to get House in Trance Part 2 when you put the next record out. If you did that, do you think people would just be like, yep, there it is. I'm jumping in on it, because it's familiar versus I've got to think it. I got to, you know, digest this, live with it for a little bit before it hits me.
I don't know how to assess what other people want musically. It's not something that we've ever considered, and I don't think that there is any way to, because it's like, you know, if you're like me, and I'm sure you guys are, and I'm sure most of, you know, your friends and peers are as well, it's like, even if you're like a 40-year-old quote unquote like hardcore kid or hardcore guy or whatever, it's like, it's hardly like that's all you listen to,
right?
You know, everybody has such a, you know, has such a wide range and taste and palette of music, but what is also the case is that you don't want everything from everyone. You know what I'm saying? So like, you might be somebody that loves dancey indie rock, but then if the new Hot Water Music record sounds like Block Party, you're going to be like, hey, I didn't,
right.
I don't know that I needed this from you guys or whatever. And so both things are true at once, that I think that there is probably a lot of our fans that are hardcore minded people that listen to a zillion other things but maybe they still want us to, I don't know, do super fast stuff. I still love that stuff. To be honest with you, the reason that we don't play at breakneck BPMs anymore, I mean, first of all, Explosives was recorded before Click Tracks, before people were doing Click Tracks in studios. Yeah. So that record is literally feel like Scotty is playing at just insane. I mean, the pace of that record is insane, but he's literally just playing by feel and we're just tracking to the drums. Like there is no tempo maps on that album at all. And I'm actually going to go out on a limb and say, I don't think there is on Stateside either. I don't think, no. Is Dead is the first record where we had Click Tracks and like tempo mapping and things like that. I think both of those records were just played to feel. Anyway, my problem with that speed is it is extremely I don't want to get too inside baseball here, but like as a musician and a player, like I love guitars more than anything. I love playing guitars. You can see, like, you know, I love guitar pedals and tones and sounds and all those things. I'm a huge nerd for that stuff and always have been. Playing at like 200 BPMs is incredibly limiting. There's only certain styles of riff that you can play. Like, yeah, you can write any chord progression or whatever, but it's like you're really locked in to a very kind of limited palette of riffs. You're locked into an even more limited palette of sonic, you know, sounds of like, you know, your template of your palette of sounds and like, you know, what you can do sonically. And drums, especially, like I fucking love drums. I love drum beats. Like a lot of, you know, what I do is just like geek out over trying to find sick drum beats. Like I love that shit. And it's the same thing. If you're playing at 200 BPMs, there's three beats, you know, there's the super fast hardcore beat and there's like the two step breakdown. And then there's like the, you know, the big halftime breakdown and that's it. And I think after Troubled Stateside, we hit a point where I was like, I don't know that I have any more ideas for this. Like we did that for a while. You know, we had two demos, the Kill Your Idols split, two full length records and an EP and all of the stuff that was recorded for like the Capitol split that became all the stuff that went on Selective Wreckage. Yeah,
that's right.
It's over three albums worth of stuff. And I just like hit a point where I was like, I don't know that I have any more ideas if we're going to be like limited in this fashion. I'm sure there's a million people listening to this rolling their eyes saying that's total horseshit because of all of the amazing punk and hardcore bands that still play at those speeds and still figure out awesome new ways of doing awesome shit. But for me personally, which is all I can speak to, I kind of felt like I was a little bit tapped on ideas. I'm like a big, I don't know. I write songs kind of conceptually where like I like to have an idea. For example, like in Books Cannot Be Killed by Fire, I had the idea for that bass line. And then I wrote the bass line to that idea, to like what I was hearing in my head. It was the same thing with Rogue Wave, that I was like, I want to have a bass line that's playing super, super fast. And then we'll bring in like a hi-hat kind of indie dancey drum beat over it, and there will be some kind of incongruity to that. And that's kind of how I like to write songs, is like coming up with an idea and then trying to figure it out. And that was just how I felt at the time. I felt like I was kind of out of ideas if we were going to play it at 210 BPMs. I think also, not for nothing, but like I also think that like eventually when you keep playing that stuff, where a lot of bands go is the like Wilhelm Scream propaganda, you know, like super, it's like we got to work more shit in and we got to do cooler shit and we have to
all day long
ideas. Yeah. But you're doing it at such an insane speed, and I love those bands. It just like that was never gonna be what we were just that was never gonna be what we did. And I remember thinking that it's like, if you don't go that way, almost like where do I take this?
Well, speaking as someone obviously on the outside of it and listening to the music over the course of 18 years for me, 17 years for me, getting something new, having it change, having it challenge me, I want that all day. So keep up awesome. That. Keep up that stuff, because I love that shit.
Thank you. Yeah, Skells, like, listen, you know, Skells is like another song where it's like you easily, somebody easily could be like, this is a cool song, but it's not a Crime and Stereo song. But like to us, that is what Crime and Stereo is. I agree with that. An argument that like I see this now. I try to spend as little time online as possible and almost no time ever on social media. But I like reading, about bands and checking out the music websites and all these things. And so a lot of this stuff, bleeds through. And there's always somebody making an argument about like what is and is not hardcore, right? And like, oh, it's hardcore adjacent. Like, oh, wait,
that doesn't happen. What are you talking about?
And I would make the argument that, and I'm sure somebody with a greater, historical base could maybe fact check me on this, but like, I would argue that expanding the boundaries of hardcore is real hardcore. That is what hardcore has always been. The two most prototypical hardcore bands, Bad Brains and Minor Threat. It's like Bad Brains were doing dub songs. They were doing reggae dub songs. And then Minor Threat by the end, when they're doing, like Salad Days and things like that, have come so far, but by the, the end, the latter half of the Out of Step full length, it's like they've come so far from the thrash filler days. And then they go into Fugazi, basically also trying to do dub and reggae. And if you listen, Cro-Mags was considered a crossover band because they were doing like crossover thrash metal with hardcore and Suicidal Tendencies. And Agnostic Front by the Eliminator record had gone full crossover. Rites of Spring, all of these things, just like, if you look at all of the bands that people laud as like the goats of hardcore, Sick of It All, like there was a stretch where like they had four consecutive perfect records that sounded nothing alike, from Blood, Sweat, and No Tears into, Just Look Around, into Scratch the Surface, into then Built to Last, which is like a catchy ass melodic hardcore record. Anyway.
And major labels involved too.
Yeah. If you look at all of the greatest prototypical real hardcore bands of all time, they all expanded the boundaries of the genre in their own way. And literally, unless you're going to bring me like Chain of Strength or Judge or Sheer Terror, or these kind of like, a lot of like the Youth Crew bands who that's the only thing that they ever did, I would say that in my opinion, that is what hardcore is, at least to me anyway, and especially growing up on Long Island. The bands that we were seeing were so varied and so diverse and so left of center. I don't know.
Well, if the envelope was never pushed, most millennials right now would have never heard of hardcore. It would have been stuck in a DC basement if it didn't evolve. Yeah. And that's the truth. And I think a lot of people miss that.
Yeah, look, there. So here's, I don't want to get off on a spiel here, but like part of my, I guess my beef with that whole, like, well, once you do X, Y, and Z, you're no longer hardcore. Once you're not hitting the benchmarks of like, like fast riff, two-step riff, breakdown. Like, it's like, if you're not hitting the benchmarks of hardcore, then you're not hardcore. Here's the thing that I think that fails to take into account. The reason that punk and hardcore is what it is because of its low barrier to entry. It's the most accessible form of music. When you are a young kid and you want to start a band with your friends, because that's, when you're a teenager, that's the coolest thing in the world you can do. It really is. It's the best thing you can do in the world, is to just start a band with your friends and just like play loud in a basement or a garage and like maybe try and get a show or something. It's like, that's the best shit in the world. But if the benchmark is virtuosity, if you have to be able to like play Zeppelin tunes, or like shred like David Gilmour solos, you can't do that when you're 14 or you're 15. So totally. That's how people get into punk and hardcore in the first place, because it allows them a way in. But then later, these kids are going to grow up and become older adults. They're going to become better players at their instruments, and they're going to want to expand their sounds and their abilities and explore their own talents and explore their skill levels and see what they can do and what they can come up with and how they can push themselves creatively. And you have to give those people room to grow within the scene and the community as well.
All day.
Otherwise, you know, it's almost like, what is the expectation here, that everybody should be beholden to the skill level of a 16-year-old forever, no matter how
old
you get? I love this. This is so fucking good, Alex.
And that just, yeah, it's just like, I think you got to, and especially, again, getting back to like the origins of hardcore, look at the early 90s Don Fury Revelation era, like the post-hardcore movement. All of those dudes were from the OG hardcore bands. Like, you have Walter Schreifels is now doing Quicksand, you know, like, and now you have all of these guys. John Joseph did Both Worlds, which was on, I think, on a major label at the time. Like, all of those guys went super post-hardcore in that era and period. And that's evidence of, like, that these same guys that everybody, the kind of that OG generation of, like, East Coast hardcore, those guys themselves, that's what they were doing. You know, maybe I'm mistaken, but at the time, it didn't even seem like those guys themselves had this attitude of that, like, every band has to sound like Madball. And if you don't sound like Madball, you're not hardcore, because they were all themselves doing all of these other things. Like, Murphy's Law was doing like 20-minute saxophone solos. And, you know,
Well, I think we've talked about this on this podcast a few times, actually. And it's very interesting. Like, most bands don't stay together for 20 years. So there's not like a huge sample of bands that started when they were 16 all the way to present. And we use like Incubus. We're big nu metal kids from the late 90s. The only reason why there's a difference in sound from Incubus from when they started to now is they stayed under that name. Now, like, take Walter, Youth of Today, Moondog, you know, Quicksand, Rival Schools. Like, if you put that under the same name, you'd be like, what the fuck happened? But you don't, because it's a different name.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
With Crime and Stereo, it's under the same name, but it's, you know, when you started, you were 20 and now you're 44 or whatever. You know what I mean?
42.
Sorry.
Let me live.
Let me live.
He's not there yet. Give him a couple of years.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. But also, look, this kind of speaks to maybe a bigger issue with the internet, which is something I think about all the time, of just like, how much of the internet is kids, is like, you know, it's like, you, everybody is,
oh, I think
you
about know, this
constantly
lot.
Is talks about the toxicity of the internet and like what a vile place it is, especially on social media. And I just think to myself, like, how much of this really is just anonymous 15-year-olds just driving up the toxicity level for everybody else? And that's why the same thing about like what is and is not real hardcore, as I'm even saying this out loud, there's like a voice in the back of my head that's like, is that something that real actual adults, lifelong hardcore adults are saying? Or is that like 16-year-olds who have just gotten into the scene last year? That's the argument that every 16-year-old, you know, cohort has, because that's just like where you are at that period in your life. So maybe I'm even kind of calling bullshit on myself a little bit here, in that I doubt that people that are my contemporaries are even saying things like that. I would hope that they're not.
Yeah, I don't think they are, for the most part. I mean, in the conversations that we've had in almost 4 years, a lot of people, like you said, you start at this level, you play your instrument for a while, you get better at it, you're going to want to branch out and do something different, because it's just human nature. You're not going to stay in the same lane for, you're not the same person at 16 as you are at 42.
Right.
Like, it is what it is. We all change, evolve, life things happen to us. You have kids, you grow up, you become mature, you want to do something different. Like, you're not going to stay in the same lane at 16. God forbid anybody stay there. At 16, there's a reason that we leave that stuff behind. Even though we romanticize it, we leave that stuff behind. There's a reason.
Yeah. Yeah. The only time I think it's bullshit is when somebody is like, oh, I was only into hardcore when I was like in 10th grade. And that's like, you know, like, that's bullshit for kids. And then like, obviously then I grew out of it. Like, that's bullshit. You know, everybody that I know that's grew up and had a life in the hardcore scene would credit it with giving it all of many of the most amazing aspects of their life. And, but again, as long as there's just like room for everybody to grow and still kind of be within the scene, that's why, like, I get it when if somebody says like, what kind of band are you? And we're like, we're a hardcore band. And then somebody might roll their eyes, but it's like, I just don't know what else to say. Like, I've been a hardcore kid since I was 13 years old. I don't, I, It's the only place we've ever existed. It's the only bands we've ever played with. It's like, it's really everything that we've ever known. And honestly, like, even if we came out with the next record and it was a piano album that sounded like Coldplay, I wouldn't know what else to say other than to be like, yeah, like we're a hardcore band who, you know, plays music that doesn't fit the traditional, you know, mold of hardcore. And that's fine.
Well, to kind of bring us back a little bit, like, this conversation stemmed, I think, from Skells and how it is a creative advancement for you guys. And it's actually, honestly, it's the way I thought when I heard Almost Ghostless off Is Dead. I thought that, this is digging deep into my memory banks, when I first heard that, I was like, this song would be great in an Apple commercial. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, which is a far cry from the Explosives era. But like, I guess to land the plane here, this is the record, House and Trance, the record that I would want from you guys. Because if you dialed it back to the Explosives era, or tried to recreate the Kill Your Idol split, it'd be like, this feels forced. You know what I mean? Like the cadence of delivery might feel forced, or, you know what I mean? Like, and even the lyrics, like, what are you going to crash the planet into the sun? Like, saying that without the compassion that it deserves might be forced. So it all makes sense.
Thank you. Now, it's never a good, you know, artistically, look, I'm like rolling my eyes at myself, like saying things like this, like it, putting aside the like low grade pretentiousness of referring to your punk band as art. Like, this is my artistic medium and outlet for everybody in the band. It is, you know, like, this is our artistic outlet and form of expression. And the minute at which you are making the album, because this is the one that people are going to want to hear, and then they'll buy tickets and they'll come out to the shows and you'll stay on tour. It's kind of like getting back to what I was saying before. It's like, at that point, you're just doing something else. I don't want to put like labels on it or whatever, but it's like, you're less at that point. You're less making art and you're more making commerce. And I know that's a very obvious and trite, you know, observation to make. It's not something that nobody has said before, but, you know, like, for example, you guys would not believe how much time I spent thinking about Rancid. This is kind of this is out of left field, but you would not believe the love and adoration I have for that band and how much time I spend thinking about them and about Tim Armstrong in particular, about what led him to make Indestructible. And
right on. Yep.
I think it's clear. Listen, I don't know those dudes. I hope I'm not talking out of school here. How about this? I'm saying all of this as a fan. I'm not, Crime and Stereo are not peers of Rancid. We, you know, like, we don't know them. So I'm not saying this as like a dude in a band to another dude in a band. I'm saying a kid about one of his all time favorite bands. If they had stuck on the Life Won't Wait path, I genuinely believe they would have been this generation's Clash. I believe that they were on the trajectory to be this generation's Clash. And that after Life Won't Wait, and you can even give them the self-titled 2000 record, because even that was kind of in the same spirit, at least. Like, we're scrapping everything. We're doing a thrash punk record. It's going to be totally not like the last thing, like, blah, blah, blah. And again, as a fan, I'm just saying this, you know, kind of just off the top of my head here, but I've always felt like, once they made that decision on Indestructible to try to recapture Outcome the Wolves, something was lost that was never recaptured. And I'm not saying that they couldn't recapture that. And maybe there's a million fans out there that are livid hearing me say this. And maybe they think that they've never fallen off and that they're just, everything is just as good as everything else. But I would say that to me, something happened there, that like that decision was made of like, who is a Rancid fan? Again, I'm sorry that I'm air quoting here. I'm on a podcast. These guys can see that I'm doing air quotes.
Yeah.
You know, like,
confirm. There are
air quotes. Who is a Rancid fan? What were we doing at the moment that we had our greatest success? And what do those people want to hear from us now? And Indestructible is cool. It was a totally cool record. Nothing against it. But I would view the career trajectory of that band as like a tale of two halves, And I believe that if they had just stayed on that Life Won't Wait, like, yo, fuck it, we're only doing reggae records now. Like, there's not even guitars on the next album. Like, we're moving to Jamaica and it's going to be steel drums, the whole record. Again, like, that's the shit the Clash did, you know? Like,
it is. That's where I went. Yeah.
So anyway, that's kind of my own personal take on just like, I don't know, man. I think that's a losing battle every time. I think it's a losing battle every time. And even if you win, all you won was the commercial continuation of your gig. You know what I mean? That like you're selling tickets and that's the, you know, brings that's the fans out to hear the hits and blah, blah, blah. And that's all cool. It's totally cool and totally viable. But as a fan, I just, man, if I had had 20 years of Life Won't Wait instead of, you know, I don't know, whatever. I'm not trying to be pejorative here, but you know what I mean?
Yep.
Just like, man, if I could have had 20 years of those dudes on Life Won't Wait doing that level of experimentation and just artistic pursuit, you know, and just trying to like be the best band in the world, which is what I think they were trying to do, not, you know, make a certain segment happy. Anyway, I think that's a losing battle.
And I think that kind of segues great into what Crime and Stereo has been able to do over 20 plus years as a band. Not stay in one lane. Not stay, this is what we are, we're going to do this every time. Maybe a little tiny little variation, but we're staying in this world. We're going to expand. We're going to do something different. We're going to make you guys think a little bit. And yeah, maybe the first time I hear it, I'm like, not sure yet. And then 3 months down the road, I'm like, I can't stop listening to this. You know, that's hey, you've pulled that off. So good on you, man.
I mean, yes, again, same. Like, thank you. The thing that is never lost on me is like, you know, I think most music people, if you're like a real music person, I think that a lot of music people are affected with varying degrees of like melancholia and, you know, are often kind of like depressive types and have struggles with mental health and, you know, are just, I think that's how we become music people. It's the refuge for people of a certain cut from a certain cloth. And to just know what the bands that mean that to me, to feel like, and I, you know, look, I'm being dramatic, but in a sense, I don't know, like it feels appropriate that it's like, there is this feeling, this palpable feeling like that you might not be alive if it hadn't been for these couple of bands and these couple of albums and these couple of moments that like in a nebulous, ethereal, but like also tangible way that like these records have saved your life and kept you alive. And like, I cherish and adore all of those albums and bands and shows and moments with such like zealous, you know, covetousness of like the kind of like the most valuable things to me. And to think that we have been that for anyone at any time for any duration of length, it's like it's overwhelming. And it's really unbelievable,
man. This has been a real trip. So Alex, I was gonna wait to the end to talk to mention this, but this will be probably episode 202. My favorite one.
Wow.
It's my favorite one. This is the mic drop.
Wow. Wow.
No, this is it.
Thank you.
That's amazing. I'm putting it out there.
Are you telling me you're quitting?
you gotta get me back on. Dude, like, listen, next time I would love to come back for another one and talk about literally anything, tell old Long Island stories, and I will try to have a better economy of words and keep things more.
Are you kidding?
But yes, we will have you back. I mean, we...
Oh, dude, I got Long Island stories for days. The interesting thing is I'm basically the youngest person from the OG generation. So I was like going to these shows when I was like 13 or 14. Daryl Palumbo and Vin Caruana, Justin Beck and all those dudes are like, and Mike Musilli, they're all 2 years older than me. So basically like everyone that experienced that is 2 years older than me. And like for dudes my age, I was like one of the only ones, Brian Lane, some of the guys from Brand New, like we were the only ones that ever got to see Silent Majority. Yep. And all of these bands. So like I got to witness as this like young kid all of these amazing things happen. I have amazing Silent Majority stories.
We'll do a part two, Long Island part two, and we'll do
amazing.
It with,
yeah, we'll let's do that. Look. But I can, let me try and get literally everyone together in a room. I'll get like Caruana and Brendan and whoever else. We'll get a like a bunch of people together and we'll try and do like Long Island, you know.
We'll toss a prompt and let you guys fucking go. Like...
All right. So House in Trance has been out for a couple months. As we said, for me personally, album of the year, it's the exact record. Two things. One, 40-year-old me would want from you guys. Yeah. And two, it's the record in terms of like sonically that makes sense. What does it mean to you, this record? Because you're 25 plus years in creatively, rookie lot, late 90s, high school band, still making music. What does it mean?
We're very proud of it. Like, we're very, very, very proud of it. We've been, I'm sure, listen, all bands would say this, but truly, we are very proud of our discography. Troubled Stateside and Is Dead, especially, you know, amongst the earlier albums, like we're really proud of the stuff that we have done. And to kind of like look back and like step back and be like, wow, this is our best record is really amazing. And honestly, just, you know, you guys can feel this, I'm sure. Like, there's something very validating about having the, this is just for me personally, like being like, wow, I'm not falling off, you know, like I'm kind of in middle age. I'm a, you know, approaching middle age at least. And a thing that is a, you know, entirely a youth based movement. Like, you know, this all is for the kids, you know, for the most part. And a thing I've been doing since I was a kid. And to just be like, damn, like we haven't fallen off and we've gotten better and we've tightened it up and we've
fixed
the mistakes, you know, that we made. This is the first album where nothing was written in the studio. Actually, let me take that. Pensioner was. But other than that, we went in with this album fully demoed. And like, so like describe you, on trying to describe you, it was half demoed and half written in the studio. And it's literally the half that you would expect. All of the really good, cohesive, well-written songs on that album are the ones we went in with. And all of these weird experimental
Republica. I'll things, call it,
like things that go all over the
Republica
place.
Republica was written in the studio.
The ones that were Drug Wolf, I Am Everything I Am Not, I Cannot Answer You Tonight, Type One, and Not Dead are the ones we went in with. And everything else was written.
Confirmed. Yeah.
Yeah. And so with the, and so like going into this, it was like, well, let's not do that. You know, like with each kind of, you know, thing that you get to do, you get to learn some lessons and then hopefully apply them in the future. And as again, I'm sure anybody that's in their 30s or 40s would tell you, you wish that you had a better hit rate on the thing, you know, on applying lessons, like things that you know full well and that you have learned, but yet you do not apply in your life. And so to kind of feel like, wow, we actually did, you know, improve upon the things that we wanted to do and everything. It's very gratifying. It's amazing. Honestly, listen, dude, if you're 40, and you're in a band and anybody cares, like truly, if you are a guy in their 40s and anybody cares about your band, you're so lucky. Yeah, that's gravy, you know.
Oh yeah, dude, that's, man. Yeah, that's a great thought to have. And I'm
I heard,
glad.
Well, I'll leave you guys on this. I saw an interview with Josh Homme once and he was quoting someone else and I wish I could remember who he was quoting, but what he said is, if you expect anything from music, you expect too much.
Yes.
You know, like this
wow.
is a thing.
I like that. I love
that.
That. You
do. I fucking love that. Yeah, because you do it because you love it. You do it literally because you have to. If I wasn't on, you could see, you know, you guys could see the room that I'm sitting in. It's like, if I wasn't on with this interview right now, I would just be sitting here playing guitar. That's what I would be doing. Like, these are the things we do because we have to. And if you get anything out of it, man, you're one in a billion.
So, Anthony, we've delayed the next Crime and Stereo record because he's not noodling on guitar right now. So we apologize to all the fans out there.
Well, hey, because this is going to be a two-parter, I don't know where we're going to split it. This is going to be a two-parter.
I will even tell you this. I was holding my guitar when this started, and then I remembered, like, oh, this is a podcast, and you can't be, like, strumming your guitar in the background the entire time, and I put it down.
Next time.
Although we tried that with
Greg.
We did try that once
with Greg, yeah, from Zebrahead, but it didn't work out.
All right.
Let's go lightning round. I'm stoked.
Lightning round. So these are truly yes or no questions, okay. And there's no pressure to answer.
Okay.
One, no pressure to answer. and there's no pressure to elaborate. However, if you want to cook, cook. Okay. First question. Do you still hate the Small Skeletal music video?
Damn. let me elaborate on this. Unfortunately is a non lightning round topic.
And you can plead the fifth too.
I don't want to plead the fifth. That comment is my single greatest regret I have in the history of doing this band.
Wow. Okay.
I'm going to say it's probably the only thing that I regret. I think about it all the time. And I will say I don't want to, offer like too much of a defense here. I never thought that was a thing that was going to be printed. The only reason that happened was I was doing an interview with Alternative Press.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a little shady. If you didn't know that was going to be printed, that's a little shady.
Not that I was never misled. What had happened was, if you guys remember what Alternative Press was like, and we had done things with Alternative Press before, the way that it was always done is that you have a conversation with the person writing the article, and then they write an article and they take a couple of choice quotes from the interview and pepper it throughout the article. And so, like, even though you're on the phone with this person for 30 minutes or whatever, there winds up being two sentences in the write-up. And that's what Alternative Press was like back then. And we had done stuff with them, and that's what it was like. And what happened here was we were interviewed by a dude who I love and adore and were friends with, who was a writer at the time for Alternative Press and was a big Crime and Stereo fan. And because I was friends with this dude, I really was just kind of like talking off the cuff. You know what I mean? I was just like speaking, saying,
you
whatever, could
tell.
Just kind of being honest. And I was mortified when they then ran the interview in its entirety. And that's what happened. They didn't take any of these things and like pepper them through an article. It was just printed like as like a straight up interview, questions and answers. And the thing that he's referencing, for anyone listening to the podcast that doesn't know, was there was an interview, whatever, many, many years ago at this point now, where I just said in this interview in Alternative Press that I thought that the video sucked, which I was not at the time considering it to be a shot at the video director, but of course, how could it not be? You know, right, how could you not take it like that? And it's not about what my opinions or thoughts were on the video. It's that, what a shitty thing to do to impugn another artist publicly, that somebody is out here doing their best and making their art and doing their thing and working with you and working with your band and trying to make a good, you know, visual representation for your song, and like to just be out there doing their thing, you know, sincerely and well, and then just have somebody like kind of come and do like a drive-by shooting on like really like some petulant bullshit. It was like a really petulant, bitchy thing to have said. And I have always felt terrible about that. And I will tell you this, that I took the greatest lesson that I've ever learned from that event, which was this. After that happened, I called the video director, Joseph Pattisall, who still does stuff in DC, and his stuff is awesome. Go check it out. But I called him to apologize after that, you know, and was like, hey, man, I'm really sorry. And what he told me has stuck with me forever. And what he said was, hey, man, listen, you know, if you feel that way, that's fine. But your band is your band and you have control over it. And you were involved in this process. You saw the treatment for the video. You were there at the video shoot. You participated in all of these things and you had full agency at every moment to step forward and make your wishes known about what you wanted and didn't want to happen with your art, and to say nothing and then take like a pot shot after the fact is fucked up. You know, and he was honestly, he was super magnanimous about it. He was amazing and was far more gracious, showed me far more grace than I deserved in that moment. But I have never forgotten that lesson, which is like, hey, this is your shit. And if you're going to put your name on it, then you take responsibility for it. Like you speak up, and, you know, which is kind of whatever. You have the opportunity to speak up. You have the opportunity to take agency over your art. And if you don't, it is no one's fault ultimately, but your own. You don't get to try to pass the buck on to other people. So I'm sorry for obliterating, like,
no, lightning round, baby.
I couldn't lightning round answer that one.
Well, no, I mean, I always say in this podcast, context is king. I mean, you guys are in your, this is 06, 07.
Like, yeah, young, I was probably 26 you know? Years old at the time. And again, I'm not trying, I'm really, it never should have been said, and I feel terrible about it, and it's no one's fault but my own. That being said, I can honestly say in the moment, I would never have said that if I knew that it was going to be printed. That totally. If I thought that that was anything other than just like shooting the shit, giving my personal opinion right. to somebody that I knew, I would not have said that. But again, I said it and it was printed. And just really, really unfortunate. And again, like if you're a young artist out there and you happen to be listening to this, you know, that's a great lesson. If it's your band, if it's your art, if it's your film, if it's your thing, you know, you're putting your name on it. So don't, it's on nobody but you.
So I'm hesitant to dig into these last few.
I'll keep to lightning round unless you hit me with another one that I have to.
Oh, the next one is one of those, I think.
Oh, no. All right, go. And I'll pass if it's too long.
I'll land on that one. So, The Explosives Blackout Era Deep Cuts. I think there's a couple still out there. Will those ever come out?
I'm going to dispute that there's anything from that era out there. There is a demo, a cassette demo that I do not have a copy of, but there was so few of these existed. We played CB's once and we made a cassette live at CBGB's demo. That was all of the songs that we were playing at the time. And I believe every single one of them was scrapped by the time we made Explosives.
Right on.
And so I think that live at CBGB's demo is the only copy anywhere of anything that wasn't eventually released somewhere.
Right on. Next one. And this is this is coming from someone who has lived these lyrics for 20 years. Did you write the lyrics to Play It Loud, Fuckers?
Yeah.
Oh, dude. Insane. I just like that. It sounds crazy to say, but like that, you know, you say like that change, you know, we talked about this earlier, like that changed my life, whatever. Like that's, I still feel that way. Like I want my kids, Natalie, lock yourself in a room, like go listen to Frozen, Let It Go, like soak it in, like live every lyric, live every word. Like I still feel that.
Thank you. I actually still remember writing that song. Like I can picture in my head writing the lyrics to that song. And that goes to show that like you need magic to make great, you know, music. If you're talented, you'll always make good stuff. If you're good at what you do, you'll always make good stuff. But the difference between good and great is that intangible magic quality. And I'm not going to get into like the specifics of it, but like that song was literally written the night after this super dramatic event in my life that was like a big deal to me at the time. And I wrote that song the very next day. And I think that just kind of goes to show that like, yeah, it does take some magic that can't be manufactured.
Crazy. I man, it still hits me. Like I feel like I'm going to tear up here. Maybe it's the IPAs talking. Last question. And you can plead the fifth.
Okay.
And actually this is, so Alex, did you read the email that we sent you guys?
I don't believe so.
All right. So it was based on the lyrics to this song. I put in the same structure. I geeked out. Do you regret For X's coming out off Troubled Stateside?
In what sense?
Well, I know there was some regret, and that was the lyrics to For X's off Selective Wreckage were in response to some of the fallout. So like, again, I mean, we're talking about shit that happened 18 years ago. Like, do you regret that shit?
There was no. So again, they're on. It's like another thing. It's like there really was no like fallout from that. It's just something I felt bad about. You know, it's like being a young punk rocker and you're like full of piss and vinegar and like, you know, you're like thumbing your nose at the world and all of this stuff. But when you're that young, what you kind of don't see is that like everyone in your life is somebody close to you. You know, it's like your parents and your siblings and your like best friends and, you know, coworkers and people like that. And so like, even when you're like, you think you're like, ah, like I'm going to, you know, do a takedown of this, you know, this, but like, fuck this person or whatever. It's like, these are real people. Like, you know, like they're real people with real feelings in your life. And like, your fucking dumb song is not worth, I don't know, you know, like hurting somebody's feelings over, you know. And I hope that I didn't do that. You know, that was always like my concern with that. Yeah, it's just like, you know, it kind of gets back into the same kind of conversation about, you know, the thing about the line about the video or whatever. It's just like, don't do that. Don't cause more harm, especially, it's like, if you're in like the punk and hardcore community and things, it's like, look at the real harm that's caused in the world. You know, like look at some of the true real ills and evils of the world. And again, this is probably maybe a lesson for the younger kids in bands out there or whatever, but it's like, no matter how upset you are at like a friend or an ex, or you know, the friend that stabbed you in the back, or you know, whatever, like the kind of hardcore prototypical like lyric du jour kind of fodder, you're better off putting that animosity towards people that deserve it, things that really deserve it. And I think a lot of times if you write something, if it's vague, if it's like extremely vague, then whatever. It's like, if you're going to write with some degree of specificity, I'll just say, man, like you might feel bad about that shit 20 years later, you know, still.
Totally. Yeah.
It's not.
And you know what, Alex, we've adopted that with this podcast. And I know that.
Absolutely.
Like that question, it actually comes from a place of like genuineness. It's not a gotcha. It's more of curiosity. And we've adopted that throughout the life of this pod. Like before we start with every artist, every label owner, it's like, what's off limits? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like what's, and hey, when we wrap up, let us know if there's anything you want to cut. Like,
well, that, and we have, I mean, we've had friends that we were close with that have disappeared and over the course of the pod and come back into the world too. And you just don't, you don't necessarily need to, and that comes with being our age now. I think if I was 25, I might have handled it way differently, and that makes complete sense. So,
dude, there's some, I'll leave you guys with this, like a story that I truly haven't thought of in 10 years, but that just popped into my head. But that is kind of, I don't know, illustrative of all of this, is that like when I stopped doing Crime and Stereo and was going to like become a civilian with a real job, I wanted to like clean up my online presence, and I went on YouTube and basically found all of any video that existed of me on YouTube where I was like drinking, you know, I was like at a show and had like a red cup in my hand or whatever. And a lot of them really were interviews. They were like video interviews where it was like in the alley, you know, after we played or whatever. And I'm like holding a beer. And essentially I found all these videos and just emailed YouTube and just said like, hey, I'm the guy in these videos. This is going to like impact my professional life. You know, I don't know, like, please, can you please take these down? And they did. And they were down within 24 hours. And I never thought of it again. I was very grateful, actually. I'm like, I can't believe that went so well and blah, blah, blah. And then years later, I'm playing in Montreal and this dude comes up to me and he's like, hey, do you remember me? And he's like, I'm this guy from this like vlog thing. And I was like, oh, of course, blah, blah, blah. I remember specifically like where we were when we were interviewed. And he was like, hey, man, like, what the fuck? Why did you report me to YouTube? And I was like, what? And I had no idea what he was talking about. And then he had to explain it to me. And then I realized what was happening. And I explained to him that I was like, no, like, dude, you were one of like 15 links. And I didn't say anything specific about you. I just said, please take these down, whatever. But it turned out that that got some like notice, you know, on his like YouTube channel YouTube for whatever reason. And it impacted him in some way. And he was still pissed about it years later. And this was a thing that I never thought twice about and never had any idea had ever happened. And I guess just I say that to say, like, there are just things you'll look back on and just be like, you know, maybe, and maybe it's minor. It's maybe super minor and super petty, but you'll just look at it as like, oh, man, like I ruined that guy's day or I hurt that person's feelings or like that guy forever thinks I'm a dickhead. Like I'm never going to see them again. But in his mind, he's going to remember that one day I was a dickhead and his opinion of me forever will be like, that guy's a fucking dick. And I, you know, You're never going to feel good about those things, I think.
Well, hey, we appreciate you digging into that. And I'm looking at the clock. We've gone for 2 hours, 20 minutes.
Damn, I am this sorry.
Oh my God. Alex, this was...
This is awesome.
Before we started with you, we did. We had a production meeting. We said, hey, this can go one of two ways. Either Alex is going to continue with the cryptic nature of Crime and Stereo, or he's going to be down to clown, and you were down to clown. So
yeah,
I'm going to leave you with this. As a 2024? As a 21-year Crime and Stereo fan, I think I have the biggest Discogs vinyl collection out there. As we've established, I've listened to Crime and Stereo the most in the history of anyone in the world. I am the biggest Crime and Stereo fan that I've ever been in 2024.
Thank you so much. I really like it. I'm really like tearing up. It's amazing. It's amazing to hear. Thank you. Honestly, I don't know what to say other than like truly like thank you. It means the world to me. It means the world to everyone in my band. I can tell you, it's amazing.
All right, can I mic drop on you? I'm going to mic drop on this. My dad will turn 69 this year. He has seen Crime and Stereo 4 times in the last 5 years. He came out with me to the West Coast run.
What?
At, San Diego, LA, the Chain Reaction. Yep. And then he came down with me to the H2O gig.
Yeah, with the Monarch?
With the Monarch.
Oh, yeah, I didn't know. Dude, amazing. That's amazing.
I think this will be episodes 202 to the 203, whatever it is. In the history of the pod, we've had two people go double episodes. And it's not the only reason why is because we're cooking and we love the content. One was Damien Moyal of Eyes Friends Russ.
Greatest lyricist in hardcore history.
So good.
Wow. All right. Man.
I'm saying that off the top of my head.
We were meant to be
so,
then. No.
It might not be the definitive answer, but like, he is on the short fucking list. Like,
hell yeah,
I mean, top three to five at the most, and most likely three. He is in the conversation for greatest lyricist in hardcore history.
Let me say this. Top five dead or alive. How about that?
Yeah.
So we had him, and then Phil Lipscomb of Taproot, new metal band from the late 90s, early 2000s. Hit it off with him. Phenomenal. Oh, yeah. Great combos. So you're in like elite company.
Amazing.
But we're going to get you out of here because... I think
this is amazing. I had a blast. I can't wait to come back.
So, hey, yeah, we love this, man. We absolutely love this. This is everything we thought it would be.
Yeah.
Oh, what do you got? Close us out.
Knowing you, Anthony, for as long as I've known you and knowing your love for the band Crime and Stereo, and it got me into the band. I'm so happy that we were able to connect with you, Alex, and be able to have this conversation and, you know, have one down the road, too, because think we keep it going.
We got to meet up in person. I would love to hang. Hell and honestly, man. Like, I cannot wait. I really want to do another one because this one has jogged 100 stories loose in my head. And now I want to come back and tell a million more stories.
Save it for us. Save it for us.
I will.
We're in.
Thanks, Alex.
Thank you. Later.
Thank you for listening to Patio Slave. We are at Patio Slave on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, all of the places that you can find us on social media. Facebook, Patio Slave Podcast. YouTube, Patio Slave Podcast there. Email us at patioslavepodcast@gmail.com. And hey, if you want to become a supporter, click on the link at the bottom of the episode and give us $1, give us $5. It keeps the lights on, keeps us going. We really appreciate that stuff. Thank you.